Episode 3.
Flatland, A Romance of Many Dimensions, by Edwin Abbott Abbott, read by David Grizzly Smith.
Part 1. This World.
Section 5. Of Our Methods of Recognizing One Another. You who are blessed with shade as well as light, you who are gifted with two eyes, endowed with a knowledge of perspective, and charmed with the enjoyment of various colors, you who can actually see an angle, and contemplate the complete circumference of a circle in the happy region of the three dimensions, how shall I make clear to you the extreme difficulty which we in Flatland experience in recognizing one another's configurations? Now recall what I told you above. All beings in Flatland, animate or inanimate, no matter what their form, present to our view the same, or nearly the same, appearance, that of a straight line. How, then, can one be distinguished from another when all appear the same? Well, the answer is threefold. The first means of recognition is the sense of hearing, which with us is far more highly developed than with you, and which enables us not only to distinguish by the voice our personal friends, but even to discriminate between different classes, at least so far as concerns the three lowest orders, the equilateral, the square, and the pentagon. Four of the isosceles I take no account. But as we ascend the social scale, the process of discriminating and being discriminated by hearing increases in difficulty, partly because voices are assimilated, partly because the faculty of voice discrimination is a plebeian virtue not much developed among the aristocracy. And wherever there is any danger of imposture, we cannot trust to this method. Amongst our lowest orders, the vocal organs are developed to a degree more than correspondent with those of hearing, so that an isosceles can easily feign the voice of a polygon, and with some training, that of a circle himself. A second method, therefore, is more commonly resorted to. Feeling is, among our women and lower classes, about our upper classes I shall speak presently, the principal test of recognition, at all events between strangers, and when the question is not as to the individual, but as to the class. What, therefore, introduction is among the higher classes in Spaceland, that the process of feeling is with us. Permit me to ask you to feel and be felt by my friend Mr. So-and-so, is still among the more old-fashioned of our country gentlemen in districts remote from towns, the customary formula for a Flatland introduction. But in the towns, among men of business, the words be felt by are omitted, and the sentence is abbreviated to, let me ask you to feel Mr. So-and-so, although it is assumed, of course, that the feeling is to be reciprocal. Among our still more modern and dashing young gentlemen, who are extremely averse to the superfluous effort and supremely indifferent to the purity of their native language, the formula is still further curtailed by the use of to feel in a technical sense, meaning to recommend for the purposes of feeling and being felt, and at this moment the slang of polite or fast society in the upper classes sanctions such a barbarism as, Mr. Smith, permit me to feel you, Mr. Jones. Let not my reader, however, suppose that feeling is with us the tedious process that it would be with you, or that we might find it necessary to feel right round all the sides of every individual before we determine the class to which he belongs. A long practice and training, begun in the schools and continued in the experience of daily life, enables us to discriminate at once by the sense of touch between the angles of an equal-sided triangle, square, and pentagon. And I need not say that the brainless vertex of an acute-angled isosceles is obvious to the dullest touch. It is therefore not necessary, as a rule, to do more than feel a single angle of an individual, and this, once ascertained, tells us the class of the person whom we are addressing, unless, indeed, he belongs to the higher sections of the nobility. There the difficulty is much greater. Even a master of arts in our own University of Wentbridge has been known to confuse a 10-sided with a 12-sided polygon, and there is hardly a doctor of science in or out of that famous university who could pretend to decide promptly and unhesitatingly between a 20-sided and a 24-sided member of the aristocracy. Now, those of my readers who recall the extracts I gave above from the legislative code concerning women will readily perceive that the process of introduction by contact requires some care and discretion. Otherwise, the angles might inflict on the unwary feeler irreparable injury. It is essential for the safety of the feeler that the felt should stand perfectly still. A start, a fidgety shifting of the position, yes, even a violent sneeze, has been known before now to prove fatal to the incautious and to nip in the bud many a promising friendship. Especially is this true among the lower classes of the triangles. With them, the eye is situated so far from the vertex that they can scarcely take cognizance of what goes on at that extremity of their frame. They are, moreover, of a rough, coarse nature, not sensitive to the delicate touch of the highly organized polygon. What wonder, then, if an involuntary toss of the head has ere now deprived the state of a valuable life? I have heard that my excellent grandfather, one of the least irregular of his unhappy isosceles class, who indeed obtained shortly before his decease 4 out of 7 votes from the Sanitary and Social Board for passing him into the class of the equal-sided, often deplored with a tear in his venerable eye a miscarriage of this kind which had occurred to his great-great-great-grandfather, a respectable working man with an angle or brain of 59 degrees 30 seconds. Now, according to his account, my unfortunate ancestor, being afflicted with rheumatism and in the act of being felt by a polygon, by one sudden start, accidentally transfixed the great man through the diagonal, and thereby, partly in consequence of his long imprisonment and degradation, and partly because of the moral shock which pervaded the whole of my ancestor's relations, threw back our family a degree and a half in their ascent toward better things. The result was that in the next generation the family brain was registered at only 58 degrees, and not till the lapse of 5 generations was the lost ground recovered, the full 60 degrees attained, and the ascent from the isosceles finally achieved. And all this series of calamities from one little accident in the process of feeling. At this point, I think I hear some of my better educated readers exclaim, "How could you in Flatland know anything about angles and degrees or minutes? We can see an angle because we in the region of space can see two straight lines inclined to one another. But you, who can see nothing but one straight line at a time, or at all events only a number of bits of straight lines all in one straight line, how could you ever discern any angle, and much less register angles of different sizes?" Well, I answer that though we cannot see angles, we can infer them, and this with great precision. Our sense of touch, stimulated by necessity and developed by long training, enables us to distinguish angles far more accurately than your sense of sight when unaided by a rule or measure of angles. Nor must I omit to explain that we have great natural helps.
It is with us a law of nature that the brain of the isosceles class shall begin at half a degree, or 30 minutes, and shall increase, if it increases at all, by half a degree in every generation until the goal of 60 degrees is reached, when the condition of serfdom is quitted and the free man enters the class of regulars. Consequently, nature herself supplies us with an ascending scale or alphabet of angles for half a degree up to 60 degrees, specimens of which are placed in every elementary school throughout the land. Owing to occasional retrogressions, to still more frequent moral and intellectual stagnation, and to the extraordinary fecundity of the criminal and vagabond classes, there is always a vast superfluity of individuals of the half-degree and single-degree class, and a fair abundance of specimens up to 10 degrees. These are absolutely destitute of civil rights, and a great number of them, not having even intelligence enough for the purposes of warfare, are devoted by the states to the service of education. Fettered immovably so as to remove all possibility of danger, they are placed in the classrooms of our infant schools, and there they are utilized by the Board of Education for the purpose of imparting to the offspring of the middle classes that tact and intelligence of which these wretched creatures themselves are utterly devoid. In some states, these specimens are occasionally fed and suffered to exist for several years, but in the more temperate and better regulated regions, it is found in the long run more advantageous for the educational interests of the young to dispense with food and to renew the specimens every month, which is about the average duration of the foodless existence of the criminal class. In the cheaper schools, what is gained by the longer existence of the specimens is lost, partly in the expenditure for food and partly in the diminished accuracy of the angles, which are impaired after a few weeks of constant feeding. Nor must we forget to add, in enumerating the advantages of the more expensive system, that it tends, though slightly yet perceptibly, to diminution of the redundant isosceles population, an object which every statesman in Flatland constantly keeps in view. On the whole, therefore, although I am not ignorant that in many popularly elected school boards there is a reaction in favor of the cheap system, as it is called, I am myself disposed to think that this is one of the many cases in which expense is the truest economy. But I must not allow questions of school board politics to divert me from my subject. Enough has been said, I trust, to show that recognition by feeling is not so tedious or indecisive a process as might have been supposed, and it is obviously more trustworthy than recognition by hearing. Still, there remains, as has been pointed out above, the objection that this method is not without danger. For this reason, many in the middle and lower classes, and all without exception in the polygonal and circular orders, prefer a third method, the description of which shall be reserved for the next section. Section 6. Of Recognition by Sight. I am about to appear very inconsistent. In previous sections I have said that all figures in Flatland present the appearance of a straight line, and it was added or implied that it is consequently impossible to distinguish by the visual organ between individuals of different classes. Yet now I am about to explain to my Spaceland critics how we are able to recognize one another by the sense of sight. If, however, the reader will take the trouble to refer to the passage in which recognition by feeling is stated to be universal, he will find this qualification among the lower classes. It is only among the higher classes and in our more temperate climates that sight recognition is practiced. That this power exists in any regions and for any classes is the result of fog, which prevails during the greater part of the year in all parts save the torrid zones. That which is with you in spaceland an unmixed evil, blotting out the landscape, depressing the spirits, and enfeebling the health, is by us recognized as a blessing scarcely inferior to air itself, and as the nurse of arts and parent of sciences. But let me explain my meaning, without further eulogies on this beneficent element. If fog were non-existent, all lines would appear equally and indistinguishably clear, and this is actually the case in those unhappy countries in which the atmosphere is perfectly dry and transparent. But wherever there is a rich supply of fog, objects that are at a distance, say, of 3 feet, are appreciably dimmer than those at a distance of 2 feet 11 inches, and the result is that by careful and constant experimental observation of comparative dimness and clearness, we are enabled to infer with great exactness the configuration of the object observed. An instance will do more than a volume of generalities to make my meaning clear. Suppose I see 2 individuals approaching whose rank I wish to ascertain. They are, we will suppose, a merchant and a physician. In other words, an equilateral triangle and a pentagon. How am I to distinguish them? Well, it will be obvious to every child in spaceland who has touched the threshold of geometric studies that, if I can bring my eye so that its glance may bisect an angle of the approaching stranger, my view will lie, as it were, evenly between his 2 sides that are next to me, so that I shall contemplate the 2 impartially, and both will appear of the same size. Now, in the case of the merchant, what shall I see? I shall see a straight line in which the middle point will be very bright, because it is nearest to me, but on either side the line will shade away rapidly into dimness, because the sides recede rapidly into the fog, and what appear to me as the merchant's extremities will be very dim indeed. Now, on the other hand, in the case of the physician, though I shall here also see a line with a bright center, yet it will shade away less rapidly into dimness, because the sides recede less rapidly into the fog, and what will appear to me the physician's extremities will be not so dim as the extremities of the merchant. Well, the reader will probably understand from these 2 instances how, after a very long training supplemented by constant experience, it is possible for the well-educated classes among us to discriminate with fair accuracy between the middle and lowest orders by the sense of sight. Now, if my spaceland patrons have grasped this general conception so far as to conceive the possibility of it, and not to reject my account as altogether incredible, I shall have attained all I can reasonably expect. Were I to attempt further details, I should only perplex. Yet for the sake of the young and inexperienced, who may perchance infer from the 2 simple instances I have given above of the manner in which I should recognize my father and my sons, that recognition by sight is an easy affair, it may be needful to point out that in actual life most of the problems of sight recognition are far more subtle and complex. How if, for example, when my father, the triangle, approaches me, he happens to present his side to me instead of his angle, then, until I have asked him to rotate, or until I have edged my eye around him, I am for the moment doubtful whether he may not be a straight line, or, in other words, a woman. Again, when I am in the company of one of my 2 hexagonal grandsons, contemplating one of his sides, full front, it will be evident that I shall see one whole line in comparative brightness, and two smaller lines dim throughout and shading away into greater dimness toward the extremities. But I must not give way to the temptation of enlarging on these topics. The meanest mathematician in Spaceland will readily believe me when I assert that the problems of life which present themselves to the well-educated, when they are themselves in motion, rotating, advancing, or retreating, and at the same time attempting to discriminate by the sense of sight between a number of polygons of high rank, moving in different directions, as, for example, in a ballroom or a conversation, must be of a nature to task the angularity of the most intellectual and to amply justify the rich endowments of the learned professors of geometry, both static and kinetic, in the illustrious University of Wentbridge, where the science and art of sight recognition are regularly taught to large classes of the elites of the states. It is only a few of the scions of our noblest and wealthiest houses who are able to give the time and money necessary for the thorough prosecution of this noble and valuable art. Even to me, a mathematician of no mean standing, and the grandfather of two most hopeful and perfectly regular hexagons, to find myself in the midst of a crowd of rotating polygons of the higher classes is occasionally very perplexing. And, of course, to a common tradesman or serf, such a sight is almost as unintelligible as it would be to you, my reader, were you suddenly transported into our country. In such a crowd you could see on all sides of you nothing but a line, apparently straight, but of which the parts would vary irregularly and perpetually in brightness or dimness, even if you had completed your third year in the pentagonal and hexagonal classes in the university and were perfect in the theory of the subject, you would still find that there was a need of many years of experience before you could move in a fashionable crowd without jostling against your betters, whom it is against etiquette to ask to feel, and who, by their superior culture and breeding, know all about your movements, while you know very little or nothing about theirs. In a word, to comport oneself with perfect propriety in a polygonal society, one ought to be a polygon oneself. Such, at least, is the painful teaching of my experience. It is astonishing how much the art, or may I almost call it instinct, of sight recognition is developed by the habitual practice of it and by the avoidance of the custom of feeling. Just as with you, the deaf and dumb, if once allowed to gesticulate and to use the hand alphabet, will never acquire the more difficult but far more valuable art of lip speech and lip reading, so it is with us as regards seeing and feeling. None who in early life resort to feeling will ever learn seeing in perfection. For this reason, among our higher classes, feeling is discouraged, or absolutely forbidden. From the cradle, their children, instead of going to the public elementary schools where the art of feeling is taught, are sent to higher seminaries of an exclusive character, and, at our illustrious university, to feel is regarded as a most serious fault, involving rustication for the first offense and expulsion for the second. But among the lower classes, the art of sight recognition is regarded as an unattainable luxury. A common tradesman cannot afford to let his son spend a third of his life in abstract studies. The children of the poor are therefore allowed to feel from their earliest years, and they gain thereby a precocity and an early vivacity, which contrast at first most favorably with the inert, undeveloped, and listless behavior of the half-instructed youths of the polygonal class. But when the latter have at last completed their university course and are prepared to put their theory into practice, the change that comes over them may almost be described as a new birth. and in every art, science, and social pursuit they rapidly overtake and distance their triangular competitors. Only a few of the polygonal class fail to pass the final test or leaving examination at the university. The condition of the unsuccessful minority is truly pitiable. Rejected from the higher class, they are also despised by the lower. They have neither the matured and systematically trained powers of the polygonal bachelors and masters of arts, nor yet the native precocity and mercurial versatility of the youthful tradesman. The professions, the public services, are closed against them, and though in most states they are not actually debarred from marriage, yet they have the greatest difficulty in forming suitable alliances, as experience shows that the offspring of such unfortunate and ill-endowed parents is generally itself unfortunate, if not positively irregular. It is from these specimens of the refuse of our nobility that the great tumults and seditions of past ages have generally derived their leaders. And so great is the mischief thence arising that an increasing minority of our more progressive statesmen are of the opinion that true mercy would dictate their entire suppression, by enacting that all who fail to pass the final examination from the university should be either imprisoned for life or extinguished by a painless death. But I find myself digressing into the subject of irregularities, a matter of such vital interest that it demands a separate section. Thank you for listening to Flatland, A Romance of Many Dimensions, by A. Square, written here in Spaceland by Edwin Abbott Abbott, and read by David Grizzly Smith. Music in these recordings includes Friendly Day from Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com. I do hope you'll be kind enough to comment on podiobooks.com or at grizzliesgrowls.com. And if you would, please tell others about this book, even if you are an isosceles or a woman. These recordings are released under Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, No Derivatives 3.0 license.